In the heart of America, on a deadly inland sea that has claimed as many as 6,000 vessels and 30,000 lives, a way of life exists that few ever witness. Men who breathe diesel fumes and watch every step they take on shifting decks. Men who battle the elements, wrestle with runaway vessels, fight fatigue, and sometimes risk all in the struggle to make a living. They are tugboat men, sailors in constant combat with the deadly storms and blizzards of the Great Lakes, men who work against the clock, fighting thick ice forming in every direction under treacherous winter conditions. Winds whip so fierce it could knock an entire crew off deck in the blink of an eye. Well, it would be easy to take them for granted, the tugboats and the crews that look tiny compared to the giant freighters that ply the treacherous waters of the Great Lakes. But the lives of those crews and their livelihoods are among the most dangerous out there. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What kind of person succeeds as a tugboat captain? What's the outlook for the tugboat fleet and, well, for that matter, for Great Lakes shipping in general? And how has technology changed life on the lakes? Our guest again is author James Campbell, executive producer of Great Lake Warriors, an 8-part series that premiered on July 19th on the History Channel.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here again.
I have to say, when I hear of tugboats, I don't think warriors. That seems like something you would apply to something far more grandiose than a tugboat. And I never really gave much thought to the treacherous nature of the Great Lakes. The content of the History Channel program makes it clear that the Great Lakes were very, very were and are very dangerous. Can you say something to begin with about the Great Lakes themselves? As you know, what is it that makes them dangerous?
Well, the storms come up at any time. They're really unpredictable. Of course, Superior has the most dangerous reputation of them all, very well deserved, mind you. You know, there's Shipwreck Coast and Graveyard of the Great Lakes. But even the southern shore of Lake Michigan just gets battered by waves, particularly during the fall storms. You know, you have that long fetch, that north-south fetch. So you have hundreds of miles for those winds to build. And when they hit the south shore of Lake Michigan, they can be 10, 15, even 20 feet.
But wouldn't somebody who does shipping on the Atlantic, wouldn't they kind of look down at the Great Lakes as not able to compete with the waves and the storms on the Atlantic?
Well, there is a rivalry between the Salties, as the ocean captains are called, and the Great Lake captains. The Great Lakes captains say that the Salties have no business trying to ply the Great Lakes and don't have the skills to do it. They set a course and they follow that course for hundreds of miles. But on the Great Lakes, you have shoals, you have wind, you have weather, you have lots of obstacles that these captains have to navigate. And of course, the Salties have something to say about the Great Lakes captains, too.
And then you also have the change of seasons on the lakes, which can be pretty abrupt.
They can be very abrupt. And, of course, we all know about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald and the terrible autumn storms that can come up in the blink of an eye on the lakes and batter the Great Lakes and the shore communities. But spring is a treacherous time on the Great Lakes, too. This spring, I think we got a report from one of our captains in Thunder Bay. They had 32-foot swells on Lake Superior, and he was out in them.
So, not a terribly long vessel compared to what you'd find in the Atlantic.
No, not at all. The tugboats are 70 feet to 110 feet long. I think the early French explorers called the Great Lakes the Sweet Seas. I won't try to pronounce it in French because I wouldn't do it justice, but they called them the Sweet Seas. But very early on, they discovered that there was anything but sweet about the Great Lakes.
And why tugboats in particular? Why the focus on those?
That's a good question. Initially, we were interested in the big lake freighters. They call them the fat boys. But life on the big lake freighters is relatively comfortable compared to life on the tugs. And when you're on the tugs, you feel the grit of this kind of lifestyle and livelihood. These guys sleep in tiny little cabins, as you said in your introduction. They're inhaling diesel fumes all day. It's a hard life. And they're on the Great Lakes sometimes for days, sometimes weeks at a time, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. And we wanted kind of to capture the grittier counterpart to what the people on the lake freighters see on a daily basis.
I didn't see the program on the 19th, but I did see a clip on YouTube that was of a new deckhand cleaning a toilet.
Yeah. And
the whole clip was on that. And
right.
I guess that's what you mean by the grit.
Yeah, that's the grit, right. That's the task they assign to all the new greenhorns, cleaning the Incinilat toilet. And there, you know, there's kind of a rite of passage, obviously, both a formal rite of passage because the tests are difficult as you move up the ladder. In fact, one of the captains in Sturgeon Bay, John Selvick, the legend, said it's harder to become a tugboat captain these days than it is to become an MD. he grew up on the tugs with his father. He said, once upon a time when we sailed the Great Lakes, you know, we'd be at port and my dad would say, "Son, go to the bar over there and get a crew." And I'd walk into the bar and I'd say, anybody want to go sailing? And that's how they got their crews. But that is not the case anymore.
So what is it required to sign on to a tug, not as a captain, but just as a deckhand?
Well, there are all kinds of tests that you have to take that is the Coast Guard imposes. It's mandatory, so you have to prove your proficiencies. There are also physical tests. I mean, you have to get a clean bill of health from your physician. So the days of assembling a crew at the local bar are definitely over.
Is it equally stringent for the larger ships, for the freighters?
You know, I don't know as much about the freighters. We, as I said, we initially were looking at the freighters, but quickly decided that the big characters, the larger than life characters, were on the tugs. So I really don't know.
And what are the tugboats for the most part pulling? In other words, what kind of commercial ventures are
right.
they assisting in?
Well, you'd mentioned before that you didn't think of tugboats as these powerful vessels, but you know, they're certainly not the cute, cuddly little things of childhood stories. They are big, big, powerful boats. They have locomotive engines in them. In fact, one of the crew members said, "The engine in a tugboat is not a Prius; it is a Dodge Viper, and it is incredibly powerful." But depending upon where the tugboats are coming out of, they're hauling grain, they're hauling gypsum, they're hauling iron ore, they're hauling. We did a run when we were just shooting test footage, even before we sold the production, where we went from Chicago to Buffalo and brought wind turbines back. So anything that keeps the heartland, the commerce and industry in the heartland going, is being hauled by these tugs.
So they're actually serving as small freighters in their own right, rather than what we usually think of tugboats doing, which would be if the Queen Mary comes to town, you know, you help to nudge it into mm-hmm. port.
Well, they do that too, but I think the motto is, if it floats, we'll take it. So, but they aren't carrying the cargo themselves. They're pushing or pulling barges, 20-ton barges that are carrying the cargo.
And are they companies, little private companies that then, let's say you are, you know, somebody who's got a bunch of grain, you hire a particular tugboat company to pull
yeah.
your boat, and that company has to be insured. I'm kind of thinking insurance here.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the insurance issues are not small. The insurance issues, in fact, are very, very large. It's tough to make a living. So I think that these tugboat operators are, you know, just hardworking Americans trying to make a living today. But there has been consolidation on the Great Lakes. The biggest Great Lake operator in the United States is out of Cleveland. They're called Great Lakes. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to focus on the small operations. So we had a small family operation out of Thunder Bay, Ontario, a small family operation out of Duluth, a family operation out of Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, and another operation out of Chicago, again, family. And in many cases, the tugboat captains come from a long, long line of tugboat captains and the crews, in two, three generations of men working on the water.
So how has it changed the business, I mean, of running a tugboat?
Well, I mentioned that the Coast Guard rules,
sure,
and regulations that now govern everybody.
What about the economics?
Well, the economics are tough. Insurance, you have to carry large insurance policies. And a lot of these tug operators spend time waiting. You get to port, ready to haul something, like a kind of a New York City cab driver. You're on the clock and you sit and wait. And as you sit and wait, time ticks and you're losing money. Plus, diesel fuel obviously is very, very expensive. So it's tough to make a living. And a lot of these operators, other than the big companies, have trimmed down and kind of taken it in the family where they can manage their costs a little bit better.
These families that you tracked, do they tend to have just one tugboat or more?
Most of them have 3, 2, 7, 8, or 9 tugboats, which they have to keep running, which is very, very difficult. At the end of a season, there are a lot of damages to contend with. But most of them are small families just, trying to make a go of it.
Any generalizations that you can make about the personalities of those who do this work? I know that, we'll be getting into individual stories soon, but
right. Just
looking at the broad picture, having interviewed many people as you did, do you come away with a sense of the type of person who's a tugboat warrior?
Yeah, you do. And I think that's why History Channel bought the series, because it was in keeping with the kind of average American Joe that History Channel likes to depict. But they're hardworking, they're resilient, they're sometimes very profane, they're tough. Many of them, they're complex characters, and that's what I loved about it, because they can be foul-mouthed and tough as nails, but they're also sweet-natured. Many of them talked about being on the lakes for 3 weeks at a time and missing their kids and missing their wives and how it destroyed their personal lives. So you have this kind of microcosm of America and Americans, trying to make a living in what's become a really tough economy. But we grew to be friends with a lot of these guys.
Any women? It didn't sound like you.
It's not a woman's world. Not that women couldn't do it. In fact, I think they can. There are a few women coming out of the Coast Guard academies that are working on with various tug companies across the Great Lakes. We didn't encounter any of them. Occasionally, wives and girlfriends of the tugboaters will come aboard just because they want to be with their husbands or boyfriends. And sometimes they'll cook. And one up in Sturgeon Bay, who was the girlfriend of one of our great tugboat Andy captain engineers, she said, I love it. I love it on the water. This is my big treat, is to come on a tugboat run.
What sort of crew, what kind of positions in a tugboat?
Well, they operate with smaller crews now. You have a captain, often, if you're on a longer trip, a standby captain, an engineer, and a deckhand, perhaps, too. But you don't have a lot of crew members doing a lot of very specific tasks. They're required to do just about everything. If you have an engine problem, everybody, obviously the engineer, that's a specialty, but everybody's down there trying to solve the problem.
What kind of dangers then present themselves on a tug? I mean, we'll assume the weather is fair for the time being.
Weather's fair. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, maybe just take winter. We did a trip again, before the production started, before we even presented the footage to Towers Productions, our partner in Chicago, we did a trip from Chicago to Buffalo, and Lake Erie was nearly solid ice. So, and it was 10 below, we hit a storm. So ice forms all over the deck of this tug. So you're out there with sledgehammers smashing the ice off, because if you don't, the tug can list. And if the tug starts to list, you're in trouble. So, and if you don't knock that ice off, you're out trying to do stuff on the deck, and you're slipping and falling all over. And it's terribly dangerous. Guys get thrown off. Our tugboat captain, one of our main tugboat captains, John Selvick, out of Sturgeon Bay, who owns both Calumet River Fleeting in Chicago and Selvick Marine in Sturgeon Bay, lost his grandfather and his brother that way. So death to falling overboard. His brother, when his brother died, they flipped a tug, and he saw his brother go over and never saw him come up. And as you know, they say about Lake Superior, because of the temperature, never gives up her dead.
And did you get scared at any point when you were kind of following along on some of these?
Yeah, I did, but that was part of the thrill of it. It was occasionally scary, particularly at night when you're out in the middle of these storms and you're breaking ice. What they do is they break some ice and then they pull the tug back and then they slam the throttles down for 100 feet. Get a running start, and then they hit this ice and the bow of the tug porpoises up and comes down and smashes the ice, and it's reinforced. The hull is reinforced and there are icebreakers, but it sounds like torpedoes are coming through the hull, and you think, I cannot believe this tug is going to make it through this. And if you get caught out there, particularly in winter, in ice, and you're over, Coast Guard's going to have a tough time trying to get to you. So it's dangerous, and yeah, we were occasionally scared, but it's beautiful out there too. It is just incredible. I've always looked at the Great Lakes as a wilderness. I like being on the water, and I never kind of considered it prior to this project as a commercial highway, but it is that. And so there's a real kind of dangerous element to it, but it's also, there's a lot of solitude, there's a lot of beauty, and these tugboaters would talk about that too.
As a guest, let's say, on this tugboat, were you in the way, or did you have to be out there doing what everybody else was doing? I mean, how do you fit into this well-lubricated crew, let's say, you know, that's used to working together?
Right. Well, maybe there was a rite of passage for us, too, which apparently we passed. After we sold the production and Towers Productions took control, then we weren't part of the film crew anymore. They hired a director or showrunner out of Los Angeles and a supervising producer out of New York and camera crews for all over. So we were marginalized, which was both kind of nice but also kind of unfortunate, because we'd really grown to love it. But we tried not to get in the way when the guys were doing their jobs. But of course, when we were doing this test footage, we were interviewing them, sticking microphones in their face, and they were remarkably tolerant and patient. But I should also say that they're amazing storytellers. They can tell stories all night long. So you're fueled on coffee. I mean, that coffee pot is full all the time. Actually, the meals are also quite good. There's some good cooks aboard. They used to have cooks aboard, but they don't do that anymore.
So it's either the engineer or one of the deckhands.
Yeah, exactly, who's doing the cooking. But we often did, well, if not some of the cooking, the cleaning up. So we tried to kind of earn our way across the Great Lakes. But I think after a while, initially, they might have thought, you know, who in the heck are these guys? We don't want them on our boats, because they're like big families. So you are a bit of an intruder. And I think after a while, they came to accept us and maybe even like us.
Do you think they were pulling your leg ever with some of the storytelling? I mean, I would think there'd be a tendency to spin some yarns.
Usually when they're spinning, what did Mark Twain call them, stretchers, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
When they're telling a stretcher, you'd get a big belly laugh out of them. But, you know, I've interviewed enough people for my books to know when someone is telling a stretcher. And what you always try to do, whether writing a book or in this case, corroborating the stories of these guys is ask the same question of someone else. And many of them described similar experiences. So there might have occasionally been a bit of exaggeration, but in some cases, if they did anything, they were understated. And obviously, it depends on the personality.
Well, presumably, the person would have to be pretty calm and therefore might tend to understate things that arose in a dangerous situation.
Well, I think when a situation is dangerous, they are calm and measured. But there is a lot of yelling and screaming.
You mean during the occasion or during the storytelling?
No, during the occasion.
Sure, of course.
It can get pretty crazy.
Did you see injuries?
I saw people fall, people hit their head, people on the ice, on the deck. When we were shooting test footage, we lost a barge. The cable snapped. That cable snaps, and you better look out.
Flying.
It comes flying. It can take your head off in a second. But you also lose a barge. You're out there, and we were in Lake Huron, and there were 12 to 15-foot swells, and the cable snapped, and you have a runaway barge. You have a runaway barge, and that's that. First of all, you have wind turbines there worth multi-millions of dollars. Second of all, there are other vessels out there.
So you have a safety/liability issue there.
So you have a safety liability issue. But no, we didn't see any really dramatic injuries, fortunately, but not that they don't happen, because they can and they do.
We're going to talk about some of the specific examples of tugboat captains or warriors when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest James Campbell, who is the executive producer of a series called Great Lake Warriors that had its debut on the History Channel last July 19th and continues for several more weeks. It's an 8-part series. Before we get into some specific stories of some of these tugboat captains and some of their crew members, let me see if I can get a better idea of why you would use, if you, let's say, had a mine in Minnesota someplace, why you would use a tugboat to convey your material instead mm-hmm. of just one freighter, why half a dozen tugboats or something like that?
That's a good question. I think the lake freighters are increasingly more are used on Lake Superior, though there are still some tug operators that operate on Lake Superior. But for instance, if they're pulling iron out of the Mesabi Range and bringing it down in Minnesota, bringing it down to Gary, I think the tug operators, they probably charge considerably less than the big lake freighters, which are usually part of very, very large corporations. They probably have a greater flexibility of schedule. There's also a real kind of pride in their workmanship. So I think that's probably, what motivates them to use a tug versus a lake freighter.
You mentioned Captain John Selvik, known as the Legend, and the fact that he had lost a brother and a grandfather to the tugboat business, yet he stayed involved in it himself. Just out of curiosity, did you run into any ex-tugboat operators where they said, this is enough, this is too dangerous, I'm giving it up?
Yeah, there are lots of ex-tugboat operators. The call of the sea is pretty, or the call of the Great Lakes is pretty powerful and has a hold on a lot of these guys. They get itchy, they get antsy. If they spend too much time on land, they want to get back out on the water. But there are some guys that have just renounced any kind of relationship to tugboating. you know, as I said, many of them have family issues, alcohol issues. And so there are some that escape by a whisker, as they might say. You know, they for a long time they realized they better get off the boats, and finally they did it. In some cases, it took something really nearly catastrophic, something very dramatic, to get them off.
I would think that there might be people who would almost feel trapped if it's a family tradition. Where, you know, if your family has always been in the funeral business, or in this case, the tugboat business.
Pure pressure.
Yeah, that it's just accepted that that is your lot in life. Now, with someone like Captain John Selvig, can you tell us a little bit about his background? What got him into tugboating? Presumably it was the grandfather and the family business.
Yeah, well, as he says, his father, he's from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, and his grandfather operated out of Chicago. The Irish in Chicago ran the tugs, and his Norwegian grandfather was the first Norwegian in Chicago to break the Irish mob's hold on the tugs. And then his father was a tugboat captain, and John said, you know, he hated doing farm chores up in Brussels, Wisconsin, actually, and he went out on the water. And maybe you saw that clip, but after his brother died, he took a long break. He said, every single time I looked at the radar, I saw my brother's face. And to this day, he gets, you know, this rough, tough guy gets emotional talking about that. But yeah, I think there is family pressure. One of our operation up in Thunder Bay is owned by a guy named Gary Dawson, and his son is right now looking at the prospect of taking over the company, and he's very ambivalent about it. John Selvig's stepson out of Sturgeon Bay, Nathan Schley, John wants him to take over the company, and Nathan is... You know, it's a tough, tough decision. He has a wife and a daughter, and he knows how often the job will take him away from his family. So, it's not without, you know, a lot of self-searching that these people stay in the business.
And competition among tugboat runners, then, is that a big part of their life?
You mean among the companies mm-hmm. themselves? Oh, yeah. Yeah. Competition is really, really stiff. You have the majority of the business now, it goes to the major, major companies, of which there are maybe two or three on the Great Lakes. And all the other companies are fighting for a small piece of the pie, enough to make a living, enough to make their payroll, and you know, enough to pay their mortgages. But it's a tough life.
So is it one of those things, like so many other things, where it tends to consolidate? And so if you looked at it 50 years ago, you'd see a whole bunch of little tugboat companies, and now it's all pooling into big ones with just a few little ones on the side?
Yeah, definitely. That has definitely happened on the Great Lakes. And so the culture, that kind of small-time operator on the Great Lakes culture is disappearing. But we happen to have found it, you know, in our show. And that's, again, why we focused on these companies.
You refer in the series to a captain known as Captain Nice, although that seems a bit ironic.
Yeah. Captain Nice, by his own admission. Captain Nice is just a huge character. Ted Long, he lives in Wisconsin. I think he lives in Eustisford, Wisconsin. But, you know, he gets impatient. He's demanding. He's gruff. He's rough. But he's got a sweet side, too. And there's some guys who love working with him, and some guys who don't like working with him. But Captain Nice, you may have seen the clip, says, I was, you know, conceived on a tug. I was born to be a tugboat captain. His father was a tugboat captain, took him down to the docks at the age of 14 and said, okay, it's time for you to be a man. And that was his initiation. That's how he started.
Presumably many of the tugboat captains have not had too much in the way of formal education?
No, not informal education, you know, high school and university. I think John Selvig went to college for a year and just decided it wasn't for him. But the process that these guys go through to become to work their way up the ladder in a company, you know, from deckhand to I'm not sure what all the positions are, mate, they're very rigorous. The tests aren't easy to pass.
Do you find readers out on the great – I mean, among these tugboat warriors, poets and musicians? I mean, do they spend some of the time in what we would call the fine arts, or is that kind of – antithetical?
No, they do. In fact, two of Captain Ice's deckhands were writing, brought their guitars along and were writing a song about, you know, the tugboat life. And this guy named Aaron Donovan, who's a Native American on his boat, had a wonderful, wonderful singing voice. We met aboard one tug an illustrator all over the tug. He had kind of comedic little drawings, and he was enormously talented. As I said, they're great storytellers. They tell stories. Mm-hmm. And they do read. In fact, I gave my books to some of the guys, and they actually read them. But, of course, you know, all the tugboats now have TV, and they tend to watch the kind of series that this is. You know, they watch Deadliest Catch.
Oh, do they really?
Yeah. And they watch Ice Road Truckers. So when we kind of proposed this idea, they knew what we were getting at. But, yeah, there are some really remarkable people out there.
So I gather that there are periods of time, sometimes long periods of time, that might be just described as kind of boring on one of these trips.
Yeah. In fact, one of our webisodes is called The Tao of Tugs, and it's a 2-minute webisode with Captain Nice, Captain Ted, as he's waiting to make a haul. And, you know, he's singing to himself, and he's, you know, playing with his hands and making stupid noises. It can get very boring. The long straight hauls, you know, from Chicago, say, up to Menominee, or they make, you know, day long, long hauls across the Great Lakes. They can get boring, even, you know, particularly with modern navigation. But even with modern navigation, there are great dangers out there.
I would think it might be hard on one's mental health as well at times.
Yeah, it is. They get stir crazy after a while. As much as they want to be on the water, as antsy as they get when they're on land, after being together for a long time on the water, yeah, tempers get short, and they start picking at each other. And then guys they have some rabble rousers aboard some of the tugs who will just kind of prime the pump, you know, kind of stoke the fire just for a little entertainment.
Just to create some drama.
Those personalities definitely come out in a confined space like that pretty quickly.
Pretty quickly. I don't know how they do it. I really enjoyed my time on the tugs, but I was eager to get back on land.
What about the physical cost? In other words, you know, we talked about mental health, but what about the physical health of people who do this, and they're breathing in the diesel fumes, they're out in the wind, and, you know, I would think it might cause early aging.
Yeah, I think it does. It's a stressful job, really stressful. Despite the fact that there are often periods of boredom, they're drinking coffee the whole time they're up. Most of them smoke. Most of the food that they eat aboard the tugs, you know, they're not your green vegetables. You know,
past the Twinkies,
past the Twinkies and the meat and potatoes. You know, so I think that these guys, it does take a physical toll on them.
And I assume that even with the high technology, that somebody has to be up all the time.
Oh yeah, all the time. All the time.
So you get some kind of weird hours involved there too on those watches.
Yeah, you do 6-hour watches. So that obviously breaks up your sleep pattern. So you're up aboard, you know, on watch, say till midnight, kind of plying yourself with coffee, and then you know you have to be back on at 6 in the morning. And it takes you a while to get a to to get to sleep. Some of the bigger tugs have little workout areas, but, you know, the guys are usually beat after they do their watches and they, you know, they go to bed.
It must have been quite something before there was as much technology as there is now, when a tugboat would not have contact necessarily with anyone on land and not have navigational tools. They must have felt very isolated.
Yeah, I think they did. And obviously, if you look at the death toll on the Great Lakes, whether it be tugboats or passenger boats or ferries or whatever the case may be, you know, in the history of the Great Lakes, 30,000 people have lost their lives. So, yeah, even with modern technology, it can get lonely out there. You feel like you're floating in the middle of a huge body of water, which, of course, they are, in that you're cut off from any kind of civilization. So you can still get that feeling of isolation.
You get out of cell phone coverage area.
Yeah, you do. Get out, right. No email, no cell phone. So you, as much as we can be cut off in the modern world, you know, you can get cut off out there.
What sort of things do they use computers for now on tugboats?
Well, they have weather reports, national weather reports. They're reading those all the time. When we were making our way, and I keep referring to this because it was such a remarkable trip, and again, this is before the series production even started, when we were making our way from Chicago to Buffalo, every morning the tugboat captains and the Coast Guard would have their ice conferences, talking about how thick the ice was, how cold it was, where it was building up, because it tends to windrow. So you can have ice, but then you have these big kind of upsurges of ice, and they can be very dangerous. But with the National Weather Service, obviously, it's a tamer occupation than it used to be.
Obviously, they have radar and things like that for helping them get through fog, but to those shipping lanes, is there any kind of regulation of the traffic on shipping lanes? Anybody keeping track of things?
As I understand it, the big fat boys, the lake freighters, are confined to the shipping lanes, but the tugboats aren't, and sometimes to their peril. As you probably know, the northern shoreline of Lake Michigan around Beaver Island, you know, the Straits of Mackinac, they're incredibly treacherous.
Because you have a funnel-shaped lake, and if you get stuff coming out of the south and piling up in the north, it's pretty intense.
That's exactly right. And a lot of these lakes have shoals, particularly Michigan and Erie. And there are a lot of places for the tugboat captains to run into trouble. And many of them know the lake, you know, like the back of their hand. But still, even with modern-day radar and the knowledge that comes from decades of experience, they can get in trouble.
You hear spectacular stories. I can't remember if it applied to the Carl Bradley or to the Fitzgerald, but stories where the water action was so extreme that the freighter actually would get, and this could happen to a tug under different circumstances, you actually get slammed on the bottom and cracked and then broke up.
Yeah. The tugboats, particularly when they're bringing in huge vessels into port, into the harbors, into the docks, they can get caught up. And if this is what you were getting at in the wake or the wheel wash of those big ships, and they'll get sucked right under. Or if they're nudging a ship into a harbor and they make a wrong move, that ship will just barrel right over them. So these captains, it's tense, and they have to be real kind of choreographers. It's, you know, as tough as they are, they got to handle a tugboat pretty delicately.
So on the long stretches, it can get boring, but then you have, you know, whatever, 20 minutes of terror at the end of that.
Kind of like a firefighter where they wait for a fire to, and then it's really intense.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Or when that late October, early November gale suddenly hits you, then it's not pretty.
What is the season on the Great Lakes for a tugboat?
Well, it depends. It depends when they close the, well, from it depends when they close the Sioux Locks in the St. Mary's River. So usually they'll do that end of December, but you still got some action on the south end of Lake Michigan. There'll still be moving, say, from Chicago to Milwaukee or Chicago to St. Joe. But largely the lakes shut down December 31st.
We're going to meet some more tugboat warriors when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Campbell, whose series Great Lake Warriors, which he was one of the executive producers for, was being handled by Towers Production and airing on the History Channel over the next series of weeks. It's looking at some of the amazing stories to come out of the Great Lakes as tugboat captains and their crews handle treacherous seas. In the description of one of the other captains, Captain Mike on Lake Superior, he's called a dreamer and a doer. Can you tell us about Captain Mike?
Yeah, Captain Mike Ojard is a piece of work. He's comes from sturdy, determined Norwegian stock. He, as he would say, he comes from a little town outside of Duluth called Knife River, and his grandfather was a seaman from Norway. That community of Knife River was settled largely by Norwegians. But Mike is 65 years old, the former. Gosh, he's done it all. He's started businesses and been incredibly successful. He's also an arm wrestling champion. So he's this big man, but he's 65, and he said he's always wanted to start a tugboat company. So he purchased a tugboat or two down in the Gulf, and he brought them up, and he had to cut the top off to get under the bridges. And when they got back to Duluth, they welded the top back on. But Mike has lassoed his whole family into the business. I think his son's wife believed in his vision so much, or his dream. She put up the seed money to start the tugboat company. His son, Patrick, is the engineer. His grandson, Jake, helps out. He roped in a good friend of his who used to work for, I think, the Duluth Board of Tourism, a guy named Bob Holm, who's this wonderful character and a longtime friend who just devotes his time free of charge. So it's a real family affair, and Mike is up against one of the big companies up there in Duluth. He's up against Great Lakes, which does most of the business up there. But Mike is determined to make a go of it and to pass this business down to his son and his grandsons.
So this is a retirement project for him? I mean, he's doing this at age 65.
On Lake Superior.
Yeah, on Lake Superior, right. He says, what am I going to do, go golfing? You know, I'm not a golfer. And, you know, he's a dreamer. I have great admiration for him. He's a dreamer, and he has the stick-to-itiveness to see his dream through. In fact, I don't think there's much that can deter a man like Mike Ojard.
Can you tell us something about the relationship between Canada and the U.S. in terms of these tugboat operations?
Well, they're obviously competing for business, and there's some big companies and some smaller companies that operate out of Canada. There's a company in Sault Ste. Marie, Ontario, called Purvis Marine. And then there's another company in eastern Ontario called McKeel Marine, which is a larger company. And they do business in Newfoundland and up in the Arctic and also on the Great Lakes. But I think that there are more small companies on the U.S. side than on the Canadian side. And then, of course, there are, you know, international boundary lines on the lakes, which have to be observed. But there's still enough business for, you know, for most of the operators out there.
But they're obviously very affected by the economy of what's going on around the lakes. Obviously, they're carrying whether it's iron or wheat or something like that. If that or corn, if that goes into decline, say you have a drought, for example, then they're affected equally.
Yeah, their lives aren't that much different than, say, you know, Wisconsin farmers. They're dependent on the weather. The weather, Mother Nature, governs their lives. There wasn't much grain coming out of the Dakotas this year, or the ranchers or farmers held their grain because commodity prices were low and a lot of grain wasn't being shipped out of Duluth this year. And who knows what's going to happen, you know, with this drought or after this drought that we're in now. But yeah, there are lots of factors, weather factors and economic factors that they have very little control over.
So at what point, speaking of weather, at what point does a tug captain decide, well, we need to make port? In other words, how high do the waves have to get? How strong the wind before he says, let's get out of this and just take a time out?
Well, I think there's some Coast Guard regulations about when they can go and when they can't. But when they're out there, if they get caught, occasionally they'll make a run for the nearest port. But largely, you know, they're hauling. They have a schedule, and they're hauling $20 million, $30 million loads. So they want to get where they're going. But, they do get caught, and they do have to make judgment calls. And occasionally they make the wrong calls. But they are very, very scrupulous about that. Again, once upon a time, they might have just gone, but not anymore. That doesn't happen. For one thing, as I said, they're carrying very, very pricey loads, and also because of the Coast Guard regulations, which they abide by very closely.
And better information.
And better information.
You mentioned some of the tragedies that can occur, lives lost and so on. What about the light side, sense of humor, pranks, funny anecdotes that you ran into along the way?
Oh, man. They're countless, countless, countless. They're the biggest pranksters in the world. They're always playing little jokes on each other. Captain John Selvick, went to bed one night only to crawl in bed and find that he crawled in with 20 goldfish that the guys had dumped in into his bed. They'll sneak something in. Somebody brought him a sandwich. John said, "Give me a sandwich." You know, then he complained when he got a sandwich. So the guy had stuck a big piece of cardboard in the sandwich. So John bit down on his sandwich. You know, what is this? And was chewing on cardboard. So just, you know, lighthearted little jokes like that. I guess that you might find it in a military barracks, mm-hmm. or, you know, any kind of situation where people live really close together for long periods of time. And again, sometimes it's not so lighthearted. You know, sometimes it gets pretty tense.
This would seem to be a class of people, these tugboat captains and their crews, that hasn't really been covered much by, you know, film and legend. You know, you see about fishermen, of course you see about the bigger ships, but the tugs, that kind of way of life doesn't seem to have been covered until your History Channel series.
That's what motivated us. We thought, wow, you know, here we live on the Great Lakes in the heartland of America, and we have how many millions of people living along the Great Lakes or near the Great Lakes, and almost no one we talked with knew what was going on out there, what these men were doing. And it became obvious to us early on that we were on to something, that it was kind of an untapped story. And then when we started to meet these tugboat crews and captains, then we realized we had the characters to fill in the story. And I'd always kind of dreamed of writing a book, kind of like a There Will Be Blood of the Great Lakes, about, you know, these ambitious, wild, dreamy-eyed men who explored the Great Lakes, conquered the Great Lakes, started companies on the Great Lakes. So that's what kind of motivated me, and I kind of always looked at this as a story. And then it became obvious that we could tell the story in film. And at some point we realized that initially we kind of thought of it as a documentary series, but I write books. It takes 3 or 4 years, and I have great respect for documentarians, particularly the whole labor of trying to find money to make a documentary. And that was something that I just didn't want to do. After spending 3 and 4 years working on a book, I wanted something a little different. So it became obvious to us after we shot this, met the tugboat captains, thought about the story, that we had what they now call a reality series or a docu-series on our hands.
You're going to do a screening with them? Have you done a screening with them?
Yeah, our screening last Thursday at the Columbia Yacht Club in Chicago.
How did that go?
It was wonderful. It was exciting.
Nobody thought they'd been misrepresented?
No, in fact, we're really proud of that. Towers Productions and the whole crew did an amazing job capturing their lives. It's unscripted. I think really, really authentic, and I know that the captains and crews were very pleased with the way we portrayed them.
You don't plan to have a kind of Titanic-like 3D version with Leonardo DiCaprio on
the
bow?
Oh, that'd be great.
Love interest.
I would never. I would never say that wasn't going to happen. That'd be great.
Well, it's been great spending an hour with you, James Campbell, and getting some insights, not just into the life of tugboat crews on the Great Lakes, but also the idea of what it takes to cover those stories.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate it.
We'll look forward to hearing more from you on one topic or another. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.